Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Richard Portas of the London Business School, who's been studying the Icelandic financial crisis. Last week, we heard from an Icelandic parliamentarian. This week, we'll hear from an economist and finance expert on what threw that country into the soup. And then at the bottom of the hour, a conversation with Patrick Coburn, author of a book on Muqtada al-Sadr, and Middle Eastern correspondent for the Independent newspaper, and there's a new paperback edition of his book, Muqtada and the Future of Iraq, just out from Scribner's, expanded, updated edition of a book that came out several months ago. We had him when the hardcover edition came out, and he was in town to promote the paperback. And before all that, it is looking, at least for now, as if the worst of the financial crisis has passed, at least for now. By that I mean strictly tensions within the financial markets that threatened a seizing up of the whole machinery of credit. The most immediate symptoms of that seizure were very high interest rates on all but overnight loans and the near drying up of lending between banks. Thanks to massive government bailouts, our $700 billion has been matched many times over around the world in Western Europe and Asia in expenditures and guarantees by governments added to extraordinary support operations by the world's central banks. All this together means that market participants are no longer running quite so scared. If someone had the time and the sources to add it all up, I'm sure the total would be several trillion dollars. Although remember that gross global product, the value of goods and services produced worldwide, is over 60 trillion. So it's a lot of money, but the world economy is a very big thing. So it looks like things aren't about to fall apart, at least for now. Banks are beginning to lend to each other again, cautiously. As I've been saying here for weeks or months, if you're bored with hearing this, I'm sorry, if the supply of credit for day-to-day business operations dries up and we were heading in that direction, then the real economy would implode. It's no exaggeration to say that had the credit markets completely frozen up, we would have slid into a global depression. A metaphor you hear used these days is that the immediate heart attack phase has been contained, but the patient is still very weak and unable to get out of bed. To extend the metaphor, we could always have another heart attack. That's a little early for more than a mild sigh of relief. And now we're beginning to feel the real-world effects of all this melodrama. Many parts of the world are tipping into recession. The Chinese economy is slowing down from a growth rate of over 10% to maybe around 8%, something the rest of the world would envy, but which is risky for China because the rapid growth rate is necessary to absorb a plentiful supply of unemployed and because its financial institutions may be very rickety and unable to withstand any less than boomy growth rates. And the U.S. economy, which by my definition has been in recession all this year, is weakening further. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported a rise of 15,000 in the number of people filing for unemployment insurance last week over the previous week. That measure is the most timely and sensitive read we have in the state of the job market, and it's not looking so good. While this indicator is still below maximum levels reached in previous recessions, it's getting up there and is likely to rise further in the coming weeks. Also, the listing service Realty Track reports that more than 750,000 households received foreclosure notices in the third quarter of the year, up 70% from a year earlier. Six states, California, Florida, Arizona, Ohio, Michigan, and Nevada, accounted for 60% of all the foreclosure activity in the quarter. Much of the Midwest and some of the Northeast is missing the worst, though as Sarah Ludwig reported on this show a few weeks ago, some neighborhoods of New York City are being hit pretty hard. The Realty Track survey doesn't have the quasi-official status of the Mortgage Bankers Association's numbers, and it hasn't been around very long either. But still, it does suggest that the foreclosure problem is getting significantly worse. In other news, former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, who I proposed should be set up in stocks in town squares around the country in series and pelted with rotten fruit, confessed in congressional testimony on Thursday that he was shocked by the breakdown in the credit markets and admitted to being partially wrong in resisting the regulation of derivatives. Don't forget, though, that Robert Rubin, the Goldman Sachs alum who served as Clinton's Treasury Secretary, who is advising Barack Obama now, was right at Greenspan's side resisting such regulation throughout the late 90s. Greenspan said, "Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholder equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief. What an astounding idiot he is. Central banks, like the institution he ran from 1987 to 2006, were set up in part because bankers' self-interest often tends towards the maximization of profits at the expense of rationality and prudence, and they have to be reined in. And Greenspan did nothing to do that. And now it's time to confess to a little self-doubt. I've been saying that we have to re-regulate the financial system, and we do. But while it's easy to say re-regulate, it's hard to say exactly how. Finance has gotten so complex and internationalized that it would take lots of time and negotiation even to get a start on things. The old Bretton Woods system established at the end of World War II was based on a world of fixed exchange rates, tight capital controls, and unchallenged U.S. dominance. Now exchange rates float, capital moves more freely than people, and while the U.S., while mighty, is hardly unrivaled. And that rivalry is no longer just about Western Europe and Japan. They're also what Wall Street calls the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Just for starters. It's difficult to see how a group of countries with different systems and interests can cede enough sovereignty to an international body to allow regulation to work without an almighty hegemon like the U.S. of 60 years ago knocking heads together. Which brings up another matter. What kind of regulation should the global left, such as it is, call for? Is the point to make the system work better, or in the sense of being less crisis-prone and more humane, or is the point to renovate the whole thing? Could a wholesale renovation happen without the existing order collapsing or being torn down? Would we want to throw several hundred million out of work and make them scramble for food and shelter with the hope of making things better, maybe, in the long run? Just who is this left anyway, and what power do we have? Is our constituency the poorest of the world, to whom the financial system means next to nothing? Or the middle ranks who have something but are always at risk of losing it? Or maybe even the more enlightened elements of the bourgeoisie? All three. Or is it just idle wankery to dream that we have any influence, or even that such a we exists? Okay, let's take a musical break. And that's some of I'm Going to Hell by the Long Blondes, their new album Couples, and sadly they broke up because their guitarist had a stroke. Terrible thing to hear. Anyway, this interview with Richard Portas, who is a professor at the London Business School and founder and president of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in London, recorded earlier in the week on the Icelandic crisis. Richard Portas. The first question I think in everyone's minds who've been watching Iceland from afar is, how did such a small country get into such a big mess?
A combination of policy mistakes and very bad luck. No one could have, and no one did, foresee the acute phase of this crisis, which was provoked by the Lehman Brothers, the decision to let Lehman Brothers go, and the resulting freezing up, complete freezing up of the money markets and the interbank markets. That was the proximate cause of the demise of the Icelandic banks. Their short to medium term funding dried up completely, and one of them had a major funding commitment roll that should have been normally would have been rolled over that didn't. When that didn't happen, they went to the central bank for short term liquidity assistance, and the central bank refused and put them into effectively put them into, nationalize them, put them into administration, and that was a big policy mistake. It was not the only policy mistake of the central bank, but it was a major one.
How are these banks funding themselves?
They were funding themselves in a very standard way, in fact, approximately the same as other other Nordic banks, rather. They had deposit-to-loan ratios on the order of about 70%. But some of their funding was from deposits, the majority, actually. And then there was a substantial component of market funding, of funding from the money markets and interbank markets.
They had also developed a large retail presence abroad, hadn't they?
They had. They had major deposit networks in the UK and in the Netherlands, a very substantial number of depositors, hundreds of thousands, actually, and some of them in very large amounts, as we've seen since the banks went under. They had done, in fact, what everybody told them they ought to do after they had a mini-crisis in early 2006. Everybody said, oh, you're too dependent on market funding. Go get deposits. And they did. And that didn't save them.
And what were they doing with the money that they raised?
They were using it in the usual way. They were lending it out. That's what banks are supposed to do. They borrow short. I mean, all banks are unsafe as a matter of principle. Banks undertake maturity transformation. They borrow short, they lend long. If short-term market funding dries up, or if depositors, who are basically short-term lenders to the banks, decide to run, then the banks are dead. So they were borrowing both from the markets and from depositors, and they were lending to investors. And a number of Icelandic investors have bought up substantial holdings in the UK and elsewhere in the world. They were also doing investment banking in the usual way, typically niche-style investment banking, not very much asset management.
The loan-deposit ratio you described was not outlandish by any means, was it?
No, it was, as I say, if you look at the Danish or the Swedish banks, as I have done, you will find that it was pretty much on a par with them.
And were they lending to any bubble participants?
Was there lending to them?
Actually, the sad thing, whatever how you say it, the interesting thing is that they had no toxic securities. They had bought no subprime mortgage-based securities. They had bought no CDOs, no CLOs, no CDO squares, none of that stuff, right? Kaupthing Bank, the biggest of the three, had bought a little, but they wrote it off basically at the end of 2007. So the other two, Glitnir and Landsbanki, had bought none whatsoever. So there were no speculative investments there. Their portfolios are decidedly unspeculative. But there is a distinguishing feature. They are very, very big, were very, very big, relative to the size of the economy. And one of the lessons of this may be that if you, especially if the economy doesn't run an international currency like the euro area or the United States or Japan, then that's dangerous because expansion abroad does leave you open. To big shocks. Switzerland is finding the same thing, and if the recent injection of public money effectively into UBS doesn't work, if the markets don't find it credible, Switzerland has no more ammunition in the locker, and they're in the same problem area as Iceland.
Several European countries have a problem in which that their large banks are far, far larger relative to GDP than the American banks, for example. Is this Iceland kind of an extreme example that could be a more generalized problem?
Iceland was an extreme case where the bank assets or liabilities, whichever way you want to look at it, were about 800% of GDP. In the UK, it's over 400%. Switzerland is on the same order of magnitude. Belgium is behind that, is lower than that, but still is still very high. So those countries are in a position not like Iceland because sterling is still a minor international currency, but an international currency all the same. And therefore, you could probably cover the external liabilities of UK banks if we got to that point with sterling-denominated finance. The Icelanders couldn't do that with Icelandic kroner-denominated finance. They had and should have done, another error of the central bank, should have lined up external financing, swap agreements, and so forth long ago, and they didn't do it.
Speaking of the central bank, while these assets were inflating to that 800% ratio, didn't any alarm bells go off either in the central bank or with the regulators in the government?
Well, as I said, the alarm bell that should have gone off was to line up more, the equivalent of more foreign currency reserves. The central bank just didn't do that, although people were telling them to do it. I was certainly advocating doing it. The alternative would have been for them to go into the euro, and that is to say, to join the European Union and go into monetary union and adopt the euro. That, in my view, and was again that was the policy that I was advocating. But there is some significant political resistance in Iceland against that. It's not majority, but it's strong. And it happened to include the prime minister and the governor of the central bank. So that would have been the right policy. On the other hand, the Financial Services Authority of Iceland, very competent bunch of people, they did all the stress tests. I mean, in terms of the conventional criteria, these banks were solvent banks. They were, in my view, well-run banks. The caricature of Iceland, Iceland's just a big hedge fund and these were buccaneers and so on. I think they're just dead wrong. I know these people and I don't believe that's an accurate description. But as I say, the Financial Services Authority of Iceland ran the usual stress tests that financial services authorities do, and most recently in August, and found that on any reasonable assumptions, these banks were okay. But nobody, as I say, and I repeat, nobody anticipated the extreme degree of freezing up of the interbank and other short to medium term money markets that followed the demise of Lehman Brothers.
What about the domestic Icelandic economy? What's the structure that look like?
Well, you know, this is a rich country. It was a rich country. They're going to have a tough time for the next couple of years, but they have fish, of course, and that is a major export. They have, however, also developed recently aluminum. They have very substantial geothermal-based power supplies, electric power supplies, cheap and non-polluting. Aluminum smelting is highly highly power intensive. So they've developed aluminum and the exports are now coming on stream, and that's very strong. There's a substantial tourism industry, and these are very entrepreneurial people, and they have a significant high-tech and service sector development for a small country like that. And that's where the action is. Otherwise, there's not much manufacturing, that sort of thing.
I was interviewing a parliamentarian last week who was pointing to the fishing industry, but you can't get rich off fish, can you?
Well, with the price of fish these days, I'm sorry. In London, at least, I can assure you, you go into your fishmonger, as we call them, and you part with quite a lot of money for just a few fish. So, and cod, which is their major fish that they get and export, the price of cod has gone up enormously in the past couple of years. So I couldn't tell you what proportion of their export earnings it is, but it's significant. It's not trivial.
I'm speaking with Richard Portas, who is a professor at the London Business School and president of the Center for Economic Policy Research. All right, so how do they get out of this? The IMF is on the scene already, right?
Yes, and the IMF. They are poised to announce an agreement with the IMF. And it appears that the IMF conditionality, the IMF may have learned a few things from the Asian crisis, and their conditionality is going to be rather less onerous and intrusive than it was for Indonesia or Korea, for example. The one thing I think that concerns me is that the fund will insist that the exchange rate float, and it's not obvious that they're going to be able to float at a rate which is anywhere near reasonable. So there are two strategies that were used by different countries in the Asian, coming out of the Asian crisis. One was Korea, which went to the IMF, and the fund told them, float your currencies, raise interest rates as high as is necessary to get the exchange rate back into a reasonable range. And Korean output contracted, GDP went down by 13% in 1998, and there were a lot of people on the streets, and there was real suffering. Malaysia, on the other hand, chose to avoid the fund, install capital controls, peg their exchange rate, and they did pretty well. So in the end, Korea ended up okay, although recently, in the past few months, they are suffering some serious problems too. Whereas Malaysia, still rather more controlled, doesn't seem to be doing so bad. So I think the standard IMF prescription here, on this issue, I've always been rather more inclined towards the view that, you know, capital controls are not such a bad thing in a world of very highly mobile and, if you might say, footloose capital. It may be that, that would be a better solution. But if they're going to the fund, I don't think the fund would buy that.
Now, the IMF has been pretty much out of the news for many years now. Are they back on the scene in any kind of major way?
Well, they didn't have any clients. They lost their client base. When Brazil prepaid their fund loans, Brazil and Turkey were the biggest clients. Turkey just paid off the fund last May and said, okay, bye-bye. Now Turkey is back talking with the fund because Turkey is vulnerable to what's going on out there. Brazil may be vulnerable, although they've built up very substantial reserves in the past several years. The conditions are extreme. So I think, yes, the fund is getting back in business, which is unfortunate, in a sense. What the fund should be doing is not having to bail out countries. We shouldn't need this. We shouldn't have a system that ends up requiring this. But rather, the fund should be engaged in preventive mode, in supervising the global financial system, international monetary system, and trying to ensure that these events, extreme events of the kind that we're seeing now, don't occur.
Do the big countries of the world want to cede that sort of authority to an international body?
Well, that's the big issue, and as you probably know, the Europeans, led by President Sarkozy, have called for a new Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods, in 1944, set up the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and the organization tried to set up the World Trade Organization, but eventually settled for a lot less in the GATT. The WTO didn't come along until much later, replacing the GATT, but the fund was perhaps the central construction at that time for the post-war economic order. Now, the IMF, the role that the IMF had then was in particular to monitor exchange rates and to help countries maintain equilibrium exchange rates in a world of heavy capital controls. Those capital controls started to go at the beginning of the 70s, and many countries went on floating exchange rates. And the fund has since been reinventing itself in different guises. When it lost that role of guardian of the fixed exchange rate system, it went to ultimately it had a rebirth in dealing with the sovereign debt crisis of the early 80s, and then it shifted to dealing with the economic transition of Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union in the 1990s. Since the end of that, and since the settling of the Asian crisis, so really since the beginning of the century, the fund has been looking for a role. And that's what the Europeans would like to give it, a serious role. The Americans have agreed, Bush has agreed, to host a meeting to discuss all this. I'd be concerned that such a meeting will not be properly prepared. If you're going to do it in a rush, as following on the crisis, which we hope will now subside, if you're going to do it in a rush, do it in December, etc., you aren't going to be able to prepare anything on which major world leaders are going to be able to agree. And that, I think, is a serious problem. You have a meeting like that, raise expectations, come away with nothing, and then those who never wanted to have the meeting say, oh, you see, you can't possibly get any agreement on these things, forget it.
Well, and Bush is gone in 3 months, too. So.
And well, that is an argument. But the consequence of that is you'd have to wait. Obama, it will take, let us suppose Obama. I would hope, personally, Obama. But let us suppose Obama will have to get his own people in. They'll have to take the measure of the, on the international financial side, they'll have to take the measure of the situation and determine what their views are. That will take some time. You really couldn't, I think, get anything serious of this kind going before late spring. But there's no doubt the system is broke. This is not a question of it ain't broke, so don't fix it. It's clearly broke. And the question is whether we can fix it or whether the things that are broken will just come back to hit us some years down the road.
Yeah, finally, after that Asian crisis 10 years ago, we heard a lot of talk about a new international financial architecture. Nothing really came of that. Do you think there's a chance something will come of it this time?
That would be the new Bretton Woods. Exactly. You're quite right. Nothing ever came of it. Nothing ever came of it in part. I think this is very important, in part because the countries of the G7, the advanced countries, didn't really have any desire to see change and didn't have any desire to enter into a meaningful dialogue with the major emerging market countries. And it turns out those emerging market countries are pretty important now in the world financial system. China has $1,900 billion worth of foreign exchange reserves. That situation has been transformed over the past several years with the huge accumulation of foreign exchange reserves resulting, in effect, from the U.S. current account deficit. It's the counterpart of that. These countries, quite a number of countries, and of course the oil exporters too, have accumulated big reserves, and they're big players now on a lot of the issues that matter. You cannot and will not get a serious approach to trying to resolve some of these issues unless you bring them to the table and the United States in particular, because the United States has dominated the world financial system since Bretton Woods, since the Second World War. You will not get any kind of serious modification of the system until the United States is ready to cede some of its dominance and to accept that other countries have legitimate concerns and points of view.
That's a tall order for American politics.
I know very well that it is. And living abroad, as an American abroad for many, many years, I see it from the outside, although I still have my American passport. I have a British passport, too. I see it from the outside and sometimes wonder what has happened to the spirit and ethos of the leadership that characterized the United States in the 1940s in the creation of what was then a New World Order, and whether it could possibly be reborn.
And that rather generous characterization of the post-World War II American imperial planning elite from Richard Portas, professor at the London Business School and founder and president of the Center for Economic Policy Research in London. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Hinman. The program is Behind the News, and let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Patrick Coburn. The full rondo from the Partita No. 2 for keyboard by J.S. Bach, performed by Martha Argerich. And now, Patrick Coburn has a new book out. He's the Middle Eastern correspondent for the Independent newspaper in London, and has a new book out, a new paperback edition of his book, Muqtada al-Sadr and the Future of Iraq. The hardcover came out several months ago. The paperback now expanded, just out from Scribner's. He was in New York City to promote the book, and caught up with him and had this conversation the other day. Patrick Coburn. Muqtada al-Sadr's people were out this past weekend with big demonstrations. So what was that all about?
It was a big demonstration against the security agreement with the U.S., where negotiations have stopped, and now the Iraqi government is deciding whether it's going to sign it or not. This is a very important agreement. I mean, it's kind of been swamped by the news of the presidential election here, but this will decide how long the U.S. will stay in Iraq and what its position in Iraq will be.
What's the agreement looking like in its present form?
This agreement started in March when it just seemed to continue the U.S. occupation. Then there was a big reaction against it in Iraq, and now it's a more limited version that there have been quite significant changes, that the U.S. would pull out combat troops from the cities in July next year, that all U.S. troops will be out by the end of 2011. This is a timetable which originally the White House said it would never agree to. Also, U.S. contractors, and there are more contractors there than there are U.S. troops, would lose their immunity. That, again, is quite important change. I thought originally this would probably go through, but now it appears the last few days, the resistance from the Sadrists, the Iraqi government going cold on it, that probably it won't go through.
What's happened? Is the Iraqi government finding a voice, or the Americans losing their will, or what's happening?
The Iraqi government is more confident than it was. The Maliki government is more confident because they feel that their control of Iraq has grown, that the major rebellion, which was a Sunni rebellion, and this is basically a Shia government, has ended. So these guys are pretty confident, and they don't really want to share power with America and Baghdad.
What about that rebellion? Of course, here, a presidential campaign, insofar Iraq figures at all, the consensus is that the surge was a success, and Obama was wrong ever to have doubted it. McCain is crowing, talking about victory. Is there any truth to any of this?
This is really fantasy. I think it's quite dangerous fantasy. I mean, I've been covering Iraq since 1977, and I find it very frustrating at the moment that the idea has taken hold. First of all, that Iraq is somehow at peace. I mean, I just got back from Iraq last week. If you ask an Iraqi how are things, he'd probably say they're better. But what he means is they're better than the bloodbath we had a couple of years ago. You know, that We now have 10, 20 people killed by bombs in Baghdad, and fighting in other parts of the country. So it's better, but Iraq is still the most dangerous country in the world. It's not a fragile peace, it's a sort of just a reduction in the violence and a feeling in Baghdad that this could explode at any moment. The best barometer, you know, people talk about the success of the surge, but to my mind, the real barometer for about how Iraqis feel about security is the refugees. There are 4.7 million refugees in Iraq out of about a population of just under 30 million, and they're not going home. Only about 150,000 have tried to go home. And they, you know, they're living often in terrible conditions, but they just feel it's too dangerous to try and get go back to their houses or try and get back their houses if they were taken by the opposite community. So, you know, if this was America, that would mean that, 30 million Americans who had taken flight within the country and another 30 million were living in Canada or Mexico. The idea that the surge succeeded in establishing peace is completely mistaken. The reduction of violence also was not really a result, it was partly a result of U.S. reinforcements, but it was mostly the fact that the Sunni insurgents decided to stop fighting because, not so much because of the U.S., but they're under pressure from the Shia, that rather surprisingly, the two big supporters of the Iraqi government are Iran and the U.S. The Iranians were pushing Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, the Shia militias, not to fight the central government. This reduced the violence. So I think that the McCain's presentation of the surge as a great American political military victory is completely deceptive. And if McCain wins the election and assumes that the U.S. is on verge of victory in Iraq, the war will explode again.
What is behind this Iranian pressure on Muqtada's people not to resist the government?
It's very important to realize in Iraq that the two main supports for the Iraqi government are A, the United States, and B, Iran. I think this is often not realized. And the reason for this is very simple, that the Iranian government and Saddam Hussein were deep enemies. Iran fought an eight-year war with Saddam. As soon as the U.S. decided to overthrow Saddam, the winners were always going to be the Shia community in Iraq and the Iranians. The Iranians will always have an interest in Iraq, because they're both mostly Shia Muslims, and secondly, it has an enormous border. People in Iran are interested in what's happening in Iraq for the last 5,000 years. They'll go on being interested in the next 5,000 years.
What then is responsible for the decline in violence, even if it's not complete? Is it money? Is it partially successful ethnic cleansing? What do you see as responsible?
Well, a lot of it is partially successful sort of sectarian ethnic cleansing. I mean, you really had two wars going on in Iraq the last 5 years. You had part of the Sunni community fighting the U.S. Military forces there, and you had really a very bloody civil war between the Sunni and the Shia. Previously, Iraq was a Sunni-dominated country. The Shia were taking over. The Shia largely won. Baghdad is now mostly a Shia city. The Sunni are got their backs to the wall. They stopped their insurrection against the U.S. Army. They allied themselves with the U.S. So you had an end to the war against the U.S., although there's still quite a lot of people being killed. And for the moment, you had an end to this civil war because the Shia largely won it. These are the two basic facts that have led to a reduction of violence. But you shouldn't get the idea, nobody should get the idea that Iraq is somehow a peaceful country. It's just the violence has gone down, but only in comparison with what we had before.
What, if anything, has the surge meant on the ground? What is the American military doing differently that we can speak of it as an event?
Well, they had a more proactive, they had more troops, they were more proactive in moving into areas, building walls. Baghdad's a very strange city now, and I'm not even sure we can talk about it as a city, but it's really lots of fortified townships. Each Sunni and Shia area has enormous blast walls erected around it. This is to prevent people moving bombs in or going and assassinating people. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to build these walls, but it means that the whole city, you can't move through the city. There are checkpoints every 100 yards, the enormous traffic jams, bombs still go off, a lot of assassinations, often carefully planned with silencers. Even in the center of the city, you have sniping against the Iraqi army. Above all, you know, it's not just the violence, but absence of electricity. You don't really notice these things until you don't have them. But a modern city doesn't really work without electricity. Baghdad certainly doesn't. I mean, think, you know, when suddenly the lights went out in New York, however many years ago, people still remember this episode. Well, Baghdad is always like that. It's been like that for 5 years. So we're just not having normal peace coming back. It's not returning to normality. But somehow the outside world has got the idea that the Iraq is now getting better, but somehow the situation is good, and this simply isn't the case.
What is at the root of the Sunni-Shia tension? I know this is a gigantic question, but I'm sure it's not a theological dispute. What political and social conflicts is this a shorthand for?
Well, I mean, these traditionally, Iraq, up to the fall of Saddam Hussein, was ruled by the Sunni, but they're only 20% of the population. The Shia are 60%. And it's not, as you say, purely a religious difference. It's a social difference that while there are rich Shia and there are poor Sunni, that basically the Sunni were, certainly in Baghdad, better off than the Shia. The great mass, for instance, the supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr tend to be the great mass of impoverished Shia. The slightly better off support other religious leaders like Sistani. But in the markets, you know, the guy who's sort of wheeling the wheelbarrow with some vegetables in it probably supports Muqtada. The shop that he's delivering the vegetables to is probably owned by a guy who doesn't like Muqtada. So there are big social divisions. And as soon as Saddam fell, the Shia felt this is their moment to take over, and they still do.
And how did Muqtada become such a revered leader?
He comes from a family who provided many of the martyrs against Saddam Hussein. His father was, and two of his brothers were murdered by Saddam Hussein in 1999. They'd set up this big mass movement of Shia poor. His father-in-law had been executed by Saddam in 1980. So for a lot of Iraqis, they have almost magical qualities as a family of martyrs. And Muqtada's original strength came from this family tradition.
And in recent months, years, he's been lying pretty low. Is that mostly the Iranian influence, or are there other reasons as well?
I think Iranian influence, perhaps, but also not wanting to fight a battle that he was going to lose. I think also if he had to fight, he didn't want to fight the U.S. and the Iraqi government. I think also he sees himself primarily as a religious leader, and in a way, the militias he led had grown too big, too fast. He was always denouncing criminals who joined the ranks, sectarian killers, etc. So I think he wanted to quiet things down. And also he was under the pressure from the Iranians not to fight the Iraqi government.
I'm speaking with Patrick Coburn, author of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Battle for the Future of Iraq, just out in an expanded paperback edition from Scribner. And we're hearing a lot here about how the Iraqi government, the Iraqi security forces are finally getting their act together, and this is becoming more of an Iraqi military affair. This reminds, I guess, some of us are old enough to hear of Vietnamization.
It's a bit like that. I mean, I think the U.S., you know, the White House should encourage the Iraqi government to be as independent as possible. It hasn't really done this. For instance, I mean, the Iraqi security forces are stronger, there are more of them. Exactly what would happen in a real crisis, you know, let's say they had to fight the Sadrists, would they really fight? Nobody quite knows. It's the million-dollar question in Iraq.
Oh, no, we're also hearing some people complaining here that we're spending $10 billion a month in Iraq. I think actually Obama has said this. We're spending $10 billion a month and the Iraqi government is running a surplus of $70 billion. Is the oil flowing? Where's the Iraqi government getting this kind of money?
Well, it all comes from the oil revenues. The problem for the Iraqi government is it's a kind of dysfunctional government that they don't really have the mechanism to spend it. I mean, if you work for the government in Iraq, and about 2 million people do, that's fine. Even if you're a primary school teacher, you know, you might have been getting $2 or $3 a month under Saddam. Now you'll be getting $300. But outside the government, there just aren't too many jobs around. And they're very badly paid. There isn't much of a private sector. You know, I'm amazed when I hear this stuff about, you know, prosperity returning to Iraq. You look across Baghdad, the one thing you don't see are any cranes. You know, every city in the world you look out, there are a few cranes. Somebody's building something. In Baghdad, there are none, because nobody's building anything.
Financial Times had a report a few days ago about the oil pipelines are corroding and about to implode. What is the oil infrastructure like?
Well, you know, it hasn't been repaired for a long time. I think this was the oil pipeline that goes to the oil terminals in the Gulf. So it's pretty serious if these break. I mean, it would be an environmental disaster, among other things. A lot of the rest of the oil infrastructure, the pipes, the pumping stations, the oil reservoirs, are all in pretty bad repair. But bear in mind also that the Iraqi government really isn't in a position to spend the money it already has. Because it's dysfunctional, because it's incredibly corrupt, you want anything done, you have to pay bribes. You want a job, you need to bribe to get that job, and then you pay back the money. You paid somebody to get that job by having other people bribe you. So it's a government that doesn't really work. You know, it's one of the funny things about Iraq. It's not Somalia. It's not that there's no money at all. It's just that they can't get the money to do constructive things. Because
they don't have the institutions and the personnel.
They don't have the institutions because the corruption's so enormous, because the parties that dominate the government, you know, even if let's say I want a job as a primary school, secondary school teacher, I have to get a letter from one of the parties in the government. Otherwise, I don't get that job. So it's Tammany Hall plus, and it pervades the whole government, which is why a lot of it doesn't work. For instance, recently, you know, one of the many problems in Baghdad is that the water's dirty. Now, this drinking water, and it's a very hot place. But also, we've had an outbreak of cholera, so people are very nervous about what they drink. And one of the reasons we have an outbreak of cholera, that part of the chlorine they're putting in the water turned out to be out of date. And it's alleged, they arrested some people, that some guys were paid a lot of money to buy some defective chlorine. They put in the water, didn't have any effect. A lot of people are getting cholera.
Water treatment is this kind of thing that suffered during the sanctions. Has the country recovered from that period?
Never, no. Sanctions really devastated the economy. You know, the sanctions basically kept money out of the hands of the Iraqi government, out of Saddam's hands, or that was the intention. In fact, Saddam, you know, went on living, and his family went on living very nicely. But the government didn't have money, so the whole sort of government system began to collapse. The health system collapsed. Things like, you know, clean water systems, nobody repaired them, you couldn't get spare parts. So Iraq as a society really collapsed during that period, and nobody's rebuilt it.
You say that it's inevitable the U.S. is going to withdraw. It's only a matter of when. How quickly do you think that's going to happen, first of all, and what is likely to happen when it does?
I think it's going to happen because, I mean, that's in the new agreement. I mean, the Iraqi government was insisting, was first of all saying 2010. Now it says, you know, 2011. Then the U.S. and the White House kept on saying this is conditional on improved security. Now the Iraqis are saying, no, it shouldn't be conditional at all. We want the U.S. out.
Which I presume is an almost universally held position in Iraq?
Outside Kurdistan, yeah. And some people who, you know, feel nervous, you know, if the U.S. goes, for instance, the Sunni feel nervous now, what will the Shia government do to us? My own feeling is, you know, the U.S. is not going to stay forever. Therefore, you need an end to the occupation. And it's only then when the Iraqi government stops being babysat, that we'll see, can it really rule this country? I think that keeping a U.S. occupation force simply prolongs the agony.
But, of course, people, even Alan Greenspan, have conceded that the invasion was about oil. Will the United States be able to get control, whatever that means, over Iraqi oil? Will it have to renounce that prize?
I don't think that the U.S. is going to control Iraqi oil. It's the one thing that Iraqis are conscious of. The only thing that makes Iraq different from Somalia, somewhere in the middle of Sahara, is that it has oil. So I don't think anybody's going to get their hands on the oil. You know, there's enormous resistance to the idea of production sharing. The Kurds have been selling some contracts with production sharing agreements. But, I mean, I talked to the Iraqi oil minister, Sharistani, about this. He said, well, you know, how are they going to get it out? You know, he says that, are they going to take it away in buckets? Because they can't use the Iraqi oil pipeline system. So I think that it's really Iraq will retain control of the oil industry, and there'll be great resistance at every level of giving any share in the oil fields to foreign companies, or any share in oil production to foreign companies.
There's also the theory that Iraq was invaded as a kind of a laboratory for Chicago School economics, that it's flat taxes and privatization and a free market fantasy land. Is there any truth to that?
I think some of these theories are too elaborate. You know, why did they invade? Because they wanted a cheap victory, and they thought they'd get a cheap victory. They thought they'd had a big success in Afghanistan. Remember, you know, look at Afghanistan now. It wasn't such a big success. But at that time, they thought they'd won 100% victory. They thought, we'll do the same there. I think that basically they thought, you know, we can get reelected in the U.S. by winning military victories abroad, that we can, implement a political agenda back in the U.S. I mean, there's nothing strange about this. Governments down history have dreamed about having cheap political victories that are going to keep them in power at home. And again, they've been frustrated. And I think that's why they did it. They thought it'd be real easy. Then when they came in, was Chicago School? Actually, it was worse than that. I mean, it was more, you know, if it was Chicago, it was the Chicago of Al Capone. It was just theft. Let's not be too sophisticated here. A lot of people looking at Baghdad saw, you know, I can take an awful lot of money here and nothing's going to happen to me. And this happened at every level, from the top senior officials going in to just very junior guys who suddenly thought that money was being handed out in wads. You know, there was one guy, for instance, was given a bundle of money to restart Iraqi boxing, except he was a compulsive gambler, so he gambled it away. But they couldn't do anything to him, because nobody could remember, nobody written down whether he'd been given $20,000 or $60,000 in cash. And, I mean, this is just a symbol. I mean, that's quite a small amount of money, but other billions disappeared. Billions and billions disappeared, and it was stolen. Nothing was built. You could look across Baghdad. And from that day to this, there are no craves. Nothing was built. Where did this money go? It was stolen.
What, then, will the balance sheet for this adventure be? The United States will leave. Will it leave in defeat? Will this reduce American imperial power? Or will it just be something forgotten in a few years?
No, sure it does, because I think most imperial powers depend on bluff. You know, the British Empire, a really bad moment, was when they tried to take over South Africa, two little Boer republics, you know, of Dutch farmers, and they couldn't do it. Suddenly people realized that the great big British Empire, with its enormous fleets and ruling half the world, was a lot weaker than anybody thought. So people in India, people in Ireland, lots of other people, places thought, we could take on these guys. I think similarly, the U.S., despite, you know, the enormous amount spent on the U.S. armed forces, was fighting actually quite a small rebellion of the Sunni community, not all of Iraqis, and they couldn't do it. So that, I think, will make the U.S. weaker. And secondly, the fact of what happened in Abu Ghraib to the prisoners there, the general perception of the U.S. is much more negative around the world than it was 8 years ago. This is illustrated in every opinion poll in any country in the world. So that makes the U.S. Weaker. So I don't think that this is something which is going to be forgotten. I think this is rather a crucial turning point.
So it's funny you should mention Afghanistan, or the Boer War, rather, because after the Boer adventure, Britain turned its attentions to Afghanistan, and it looks like Barack Obama would have us do the same.
I think there's just an underestimation of how difficult these places will be, how difficult it is to win a military victory. I mean, the U.S. could be influential in Afghanistan if it had limited aims, but not to run the country, but to support an Afghan government. But an Afghan government would have to basically fight its own battles, and an Afghan government which is truly independent. But I think if there are generalized aims of, you know, what's the U.S., what's Britain doing in Afghanistan, nobody quite knows what their aims are. And, I mean, there was always an absurdity about intervention in Afghanistan, that the Taliban were really a creation of Pakistani military intelligence. Yet what does Bush do? But he allied himself with Musharraf, who are the guys who had created and fostered the Taliban and ensured they came back in Afghanistan. This is always a completely contradictory policy. Funnily, one of the strange things, the administration has taken a lot of flak criticism for its Iraq policy, but probably not enough for its Afghan policy, which, if anything, was even stupider.
We've been listening to Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent, the British daily newspaper, and author of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Battle for the Future of Iraq, just out in an expanded paperback edition from Scribner. His book, The Occupation, about an earlier phase of the disaster in Iraq, was published back in 2006 by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this rousing bit of decadence from Kissy Sellout. Till next week,
Bye.
Y'all ready for this? She had a place in Soho, a dominatrix sex pad. She came me up and with me, was the best fun I ever had. So there I was, butt naked, getting spanked like a schoolboy. We're in, what's a boyfriend? I pass it by the name of Big Boy. Punch on my right cheek, let me kick me out the window. I landed in a trash heap and fell asleep like a hobo. Lost in the KO, never going there again. Lost in the KO, when's this gonna end? So here I am naked, all on my Jack Jones. I haven't got a Scooby of how I'm gonna get home. Phone starts ringing, it's a girl from another four. She said Big Boy's gone out, wanna come back for more? KO, 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 KO.